In an order that all sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings maintain Buddhahood, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. In order that all sentient beings, from my heart I take refuge in the three jewels. Whatever the virtues of the many fields of knowledge, all are steps on the path of omniscience. May these arise in the clear mirror of intellect. O Manjushri, please accomplish this. Okay, good evening. Welcome. Thanks for joining in again. Hi, everyone. Tonight we continue tracing the development of Buddhist thought into the first millennium of our time period, as we count the time in these days or worlds. And so we have Nagarjuna living in like one or so, 150, 200 in the common era. And a gentleman who's supposedly said to be his disciple, Aryadeva. And Nagarjuna puts forth a whole series of texts, quite a number of texts, in the three types that we went through last time of philosophical praises, and then a sort of expository writings, like the letter to the king, as well as numerous other texts that are ascribed to him. And then we have Aryadeva, who is his disciple and does not write any commentary on Nagarjuna's texts, which is suspicious. Somehow, I'd like to look at like the literary history, like when did these things appear, or supposedly appear, and who wrote what. And like the gaps, I think is interesting in the time periods. So we don't have significant commentaries on Nagarjuna for like 300 years. Buddhapalita writes a commentary. So 300 years later, you know, when we look back 2,500 years, it's like, oh, 300 years. But like if you're living in 300 years, that's a really long time for their not to be any further exposition of this groundbreaking new philosophical understanding and movement that Nagarjuna put forth. Aryadeva does have one text that's similar called the 400 stanzas, more like the Ratnavali or the letter to the king in terms of being a sort of didactic presentation of the path and things like that. But otherwise, there's this big splash, and, you know, obviously lots of texts get lost in the wash, so to speak, but it's just a little bit odd.
What is sort of interesting is that we do have a text called the Akutobaya, which is sometimes attributed to Nagarjuna himself, that seems to have been potentially a series of expository notes that was circulated along with the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, whose authorship is not entirely certain. And what's very interesting is that when Buddhapalita comes to write his commentary, he borrows from that text very extensively. And in fact, the last five chapters of it are of Buddhapalita's texts are basically identical to those in the Akutobaya. So there does appear to have been some sort of existing commentarial tradition, but the authorship is far from well documented.
Yeah, that's another fascinating example where this text, Akutobaya, is in the literary record, and the authorship is uncertain. It's not signed, and it's not really ascribed to anybody in the early tradition. And as Chris said, Buddhapalita in addition to the last five chapters, overall, a full third of his commentary is identical to this Kutobaya. So the fine art of plagiarism flourishing early on in Buddhist circles is blatantly evident there. But why would that be? Why would he feel entitled to just completely lifting that text? It seems like there was a difference in ownership of texts and writings than we seem to have. Of like, we can go both ways of like being puffed up about something, or just like I should own that this is my point of view, and put my name on it, and it's just a very different mindset that they could incorporate so much of another text into his and call it his commentary. Although he doesn't really come up with a name, and it's not clear that that's his title for his text, because it's just Buddha Politics commentary. So.
It may have been that this was something of a working document that was passed from, various commentators to another as a means of elucidating to students, but not something that necessarily existed as a work unto itself. And this is just sort of Buddha Palita's, additions and extra notes on a pre-existing commentarial document.
Yeah, that is the general belief that might have even been Nagarjuna's side notes of sorts that then just got passed down. But it's just so curious that that would get passed down and no one else would write commentaries on this presentation for so many hundreds of years. Anyway, so Buddha Politics comes along and expands somewhat on Nagarjuna's texts, but it's not what you would call a lengthy exposition, it seems, of Nagarjuna's Mulla-Madhyamaka-Karaka, his Buddha Politics commentary. And he uses this style of exposition called prasanga, which is consequence. And Jan Westerhoff makes a really important distinction in his discussion of this, that in the West, when we say, what is it, something ad infinitum or absurdum,
Reductio ad
recta,
absurdum.
yeah, that basically means you destroy one point of view and thereby assert another point of view. And that the Prasangika method in Indian logic and Buddha Palita's use of it did not do the second part. It just destroyed the version, the view being expressed without expressing something else. And so, before like diving in further, I think there's some interesting thing going on about like the style of teaching, where it's almost like a Zen style of teaching of Nagarjuna, of just like blowing your mind, like taking all these categories and say these doesn't make any sense, this doesn't make any sense, and just these verses over and over again of how can this be and how can this be. And if he didn't write all these other texts about the path and everything, I think he would have been charged with the same faults that the mythical Huayan was charged with when Buddhism came into Tibet, where you have this debate between Kamalashila representing the Indian gradual path and Mahoyan, Huayan representing the Chinese instantaneous Zen path that pays no attention to karma and doing anything, but just this idea that instantaneously realizing that you are a Buddha. So Nagarjuna has that sort of radical quality early on, a sort of shock treatment. Shock. What's the term shock and
Shock and awe.
shock and awe technique, which is great. And so then the explanation that we get of the evolution of the tradition is that 300 years later, Buddhapada basically repeats the same MO of shock and awe with like a little bit further fleshing out and expansion on it. And then suddenly, 100 years later, and again, 100 years is not a sudden a sudden blink of an eye, right? That's like a number of generations, a very long lifetime, 100 years. And so things might have changed dramatically in that 100 years. What is it that came about that made Bhava Viveka react so differently to the way of expounding on Nagarjuna's text? And the two authors that we have talk about how the milieu, there was a the milieu of debate was going on in India, and that in order to retain your royal patronage or patronage of donors for your monastery, you had to win debates. And debating using the Prasanga method was not viewed favorably. And so there's some sense that maybe Bhava Viveka was coming up with the more extensive method of what's called Swatantra, of own thesis or own syllogism, or an assertion that relies, that can stand on its own, potentially f in order to support the Sangha and win debates and promote the Buddhist teachings and create their continuity, as opposed to it necessarily being some, how much did he believe his own rhetoric that Bhava Viveka was like wrong, or was it just not skillful and effective in the situation there? Anyway,
The rules of the debate were that if you won the debate, then your opponent had to convert to your view. Is that correct?
that's what they say. It's like the Mayan basketball games. It's like you had to convert or you would be killed or exiled. So that's what they said. I think they exaggerate these things, maybe.
The stakes to winning these debates were pretty high. You could
Yeah.
end up as a Hindu.
Yeah, so how come Buddhapada wasn't inspired by that? Where was it just not a thing, or it's possible he had like an awesome presence and a mode of delivery, and it worked. But it's a curious thing to think about these texts from that sort of sociological point of view, as opposed to like these statements of ultimate philosophical presentation of like, this is the correct soteriological path to enlightenment, sort of thing.
I think the other important figure to note here is Dignaga, who was a contemporary of Buddhapada. But by the time Bhava Viveka came around later, his contributions were very, I don't know, hot on the scene, I guess. And so one reading of Buddhapada, Dignaga really brought a level of formal, what we could call formal logic and syllogism and rigor to the Buddhist tradition. And in many ways, what Bhava Viveka is doing is bringing that new style of argumentation, which is in many ways an old style, but sort of streamlined. Bringing that to the Madhyamaka tradition, and sort of an act of innovation, trying to keep Madhyamaka relevant with the, development of the times.
That is a very weighty argument there. That the influence of Dignaga on the tradition resulted in this shift into incorporating logic into the way of understanding emptiness. So I thought, and Chris was okay with the idea of looking at the first chapter of the Karika, which we went through last week again, and seeing to what extent could we see it as prasanga or swatantra. And we have our clunky translation, but it was okay. See, where is it in the source book? Oh, I'm too far. So we have the first karika as sort of the proposition, that causation from the four extremes does not hold water. There is no production from self, other, both, or without a cause. And then he shifts into the four conditions. And so he states, okay, here's our basic scheme for understanding causation, the so-called fourfold classification of conditions provide the context for causation, which we went through last time. And then he says the essence of entities, so that which is caused is not present in the conditions. So, if there is no essence, there can be no otherness essence. So, is this prasanga or swatantra, and in what sense? Chris, do you have any thoughts?
That second stanza does almost feel like he is accepting a premise, right? Saying that these are the four conditions. But what he then does in the following lines is tears each of them down one by one. So if we read that second as, coming out of the mouth of someone he's talking to rather than himself, and then he's offering his response. It seems as though this paragraph is functioning, or this these slokas are functioning as setting up the argument that he then rejects. So I think this is all prasanga.
So let's see if we can go through it a little bit systematically. So the second one says, okay, here's our framework for causation. We have this scheme of the four conditions. And then he says, his argument is that he goes through them one at a time. The essence of entities is not presence. So that's his conclusion, right? Svabhava basically is not present in these conditions, and if it's not present, there can be no other. We looked at other translations of this. What was this? There can be no otherness essence. There can be no essence of the result if the essence doesn't exist in the conditions. Then the essence cannot, or Swabhava cannot come about from as being other than those conditions. So then he goes through his reasoning. Power to act, which is one of them, it's the efficient condition, right? Does not have conditions. There is no power to act without conditions. There are no conditions without power to act, nor do any have the power to act. So he seems to be taking apart the idea that conditions bring about something, have productive capability. So we talked about swabhava earlier, two aspects of phenomena in the Abhidharma tradition, swabhava and then karitra, productive capacity. And productive capacity can't have been brought about by conditions, nor can it can there be any self-arisen. So here he's sort of like just repeating his statement. Of like four different ways of looking at the productive capacity of conditions. These give rise to those, so these are called conditions, as long as those do not come from these. Why are these not non-conditions? So what makes an argument Swatantra, according to the authors, is that Bhava-viveka is complaining that Buddhapalita does not include a reason and an example. And we have this presentation of the format of a syllogism, which is a philosophical proposition on page 125 of the Golden Age. At first, he says Bhava-viveka's response to Buddhapalita. So, actually to start a little bit earlier, we have Nagarjuna's. He gives Nagarjuna's opening statement on 124. Not from themselves, not from another, both no cause do any originated entities ever exist anywhere. And then Buddhapalita comments on that, says to begin with, entities do not originate from their own selves. Because their origination would be pointless and because there would be no end to origination. So he gives a reason. Yes?
Yes.
But he doesn't
Which
give
is
it.
more than Nagarjuna gives us.
Yeah, Nagarjuna does not give a reason. He expects you to, well, he does not at that point. Buddhapalita then says, for there is no purpose in the origination again of entities that exist by their own selves. If they do originate again, even though they exist, never would they not be originating. So that is the absurd conclusion. That too is not accepted. Those two possible scenarios, if there's no purpose. Let's see. First, they don't originate from themselves because their origination would be pointless and there'd be no end to them originating. And they would be constantly originating. So that's not acceptable. So he gives some reasoning and a conclusion. And then shifting to, Bhava-viveka's response, he says, that's not right, because no reason and example are given, and because faults stated by the opponent are not answered. Because it's a prasangika argument, a property to be proved, and a property which proves that, and a property which proves that are opposite in meaning become manifest by reversing the original meaning. property to be proved and a property which proves that. And a property which proves that are opposite in meaning. That's a little bit confusing. Property that which proves. A property to be proved and a property which proves that are two different opposite things in meaning. And they become manifest by reversing the original meaning. Entities originate from another because origination has a result and because origination has an end. So, because it's a prasanga argument, the meaning becomes manifest by reversing the original. And I think he gives that. He says, entities originate from another because origination has a result, that is, produces something else, and because origination has an end, it stops producing. Therefore, it can't, origination from self does not make any sense, because origination from oneself would, there would be no point to it, and it would go on forever. And he gives the opposite here. It does have a point, it has a result, and it has an end. So here manages to condense a number of points into few words, worthwhile to unpack them carefully. First of all, he points out that reason and example are missing from Buddhapada. Bhavaveka thinks Nagarjuna's argument should be presented in a commentary in the form of a three-membered syllogism, which would include reason and examples, such as a thesis which ascribes the inferred property to the subject of the argument. So, what's the subject of the argument? I think the subject of the argument is anything. By subject, we mean like the grammatical subject, like the main agent.
The result, because this is a sentence about, this is a syllogism about, or he seeks to make it a syllogism about causation. The subject is the result. Where does the result come from? Is that right?
I would say that a thing like svabhava is the subject, and
Okay.
he's ascribing an inferred property to that subject. And the inferred property is that it's not produced by self, other, both, or neither. A reason which ascribes the inferring property to the subject of the argument. So what is the reason, what is the supporting reason to saying that nothing whatever arises? And the reasoning given is that an essence is not present in the conditions, and if there's no essence, then there can be no otherness. And then an example of something that has both the inferred and the inferred. So then he flesh Westerhoff fleshes out Bhavaviveka's syllogism and says the one that Bhavaviveka supplies in support of Nagarjuna's claim that entities do not originate from themselves and is the following. So that's his thesis, is that entities, things, do not originate from themselves, taking the first part of the tetralemma. The six sense organs, for example, are which are the subject in this case, do not originate from themselves. That's the inferred property, because the sense organs already exist, is the reason. And the example is, well, take consciousness. So in the case of Nagarjuna, he's saying phenomena, things are not, do not arise from self, other, both, or neither, because because you can't find them in the conditions, and there is no other, you can't find them outside of the conditions. Something like that. So maybe let's continue with the Western on the next page, 126. Bhava Viveka only presents us with a particular instance of a general thesis, whereas Nagarjuna is not specifically talking about the sense organs. Bhava Viveka makes it specific, but he clearly presupposes that a similar syllogism can be produced for any potential, sorry, candidate for self-production. Potential candidate would be any phenomena that possesses svabhava, asking, is it produced from self? The sense organs do not cause themselves because they already exist. So by the way, this statement, the sense organs do not cause themselves because they already exist, and the example that he gave on the page before of the six senses do not originate from themselves because they exist like consciousness. Is that structure understandable? Like, do folks get like, why isn't he talking about the moment when the sixth sense consciousnesses don't exist, and as opposed to the moment when the sixth sense consciousnesses already exist? In his analysis, Rob.
Because if they don't exist, then they can't create from themselves.
Right, so he's arguing against the first part of the tetralemma, which is phenomena do not arise from themselves. So you have a phenomena, and then to say that it arose from itself means that the phenomena is already there. So, let's see, we're on 126. The sense organs do not cause themselves because they already exist in this example. And anything that presently exists no longer requires production. With the example Bhava Viveka mentions consciousness, he makes a reference to the Samkhya Satkaryavada theory of the pre-existence of the effect of the cause. The Samkhya consider Chaitanya to be another name of Purusha, blah, 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 blah. Okay, so the next paragraph. When Bhava Viveka speaks about reversing the original meaning, he has in mind a reader of Buddhapada's commentary who, having been convinced by the Prasanga argument that self-causation has the contradictory consequence of producing something that is already there and continuing to produce it perpetually. That's a long sentence. He has in mind a reader Buddhapada's commentary who he's convinced of the reasoning. He might then infer that for this reason, objects must be caused by what is different from them. It must be option two. If door number one didn't work, then it must be door number two, production from other. As we experience causation to produce what is not there, and not doing so incessantly, they produce what's not there once, and they don't go on producing what's not there incessantly. In other words, the reader would have misunderstood the Prasanga argument as a reductio. So we would, the reader, Bhavavik is complaining that with Buddhapada, you could misunderstand Buddhapada's negation of production by itself to mean that he's asserting, well, there is production of other, because he didn't cover that, right? So in other words, the reader had misunderstood the Prasanga argument as reductio, where the rejection of one alternative entails the adoption of other. But Bhavaviveka believes that this is a danger connected with employing the Prasanga methodology, as it does not endorse any positive thesis or proposition. People might mistakenly adopt a negation of one rejected option, even though it is fundamentally as deficient as the original position. In doing so, he's making a distinction between these two, this two types of negation that becomes really important in this tradition. Chris, you want to go through those?
Sure.
The next paragraph there.
So again, we're at the last paragraph in page 126. He underlines this point by referring to the difference between two kinds of negation, implicative paryudasa and non-implicative negation, prasajya pratisada. Not a Sanskrit speaker. Originally a grammatical distinction, it was first given a substantial philosophical role by Bhavaveka. An implicative negation automatically endorses one of the remaining alternatives, as when saying that a man is a non-Brahmin, we assert that he is a member of one of the other castes. On the other hand, we can also formulate matters slightly differently by saying that a man is not a Brahmin, and mean by this that he does not belong to any of the other castes either, because the caste system is not applicable to him, or because he lives at a time when there are no castes, and so on. The exact way in which implicative and non-implicative negations are expressed grammatically does not matter. What is important is that we mean different things by them. Now, Bhavaveka argues that when Nagarjuna negates a position, such as that things are self-caused, he does so in a non-implicative manner, without committing himself to any of the other ways in which a thing could be causally produced. From a Madhyamaka perspective, this makes sense, since non-implicative negations are usually employed when we want to inject a presupposition made by both the statement and its negation. When we deny that the number three is red, we do not want to say that it has another color instead, that is, negated in an implicative manner, but deny that numbers could have any color at all. In the same way, the different alternatives rejected in Madhyamaka arguments have the shared property of presupposing the existence of objects with svabhava in some form, and if we negate them individually by non-implicative negation, that is motivated by our rejection of this underlying assumption. Does that clear the difference between implicative and non-implicative negations? Cool.
And most of us have been through that a number of times. So then he points out on 127, the first. Sorry.
Well, what's interesting is that he makes this distinction and then sort of uncharitably suggests that Buddhapalita is making the Prasanga method is implying implicative negations, or is at least open to that reading. In other words, as Westerhoff puts it, misunderstanding Prasanga as reductio. So he understands the difference and is sort of innovative in articulating the difference, but takes an uncharitable reading.
An uncharitable beating. Then he goes on to point out on 127 that Bhavaviveka's insistence or tendency to spell out the Madhyamaka arguments in the form of syllogisms is different than what the master himself did and might be viewed as being contradictory to that. So he has to somehow justify his rationale for doing this. Otherwise, like, why didn't the master do himself do this? And Westerhoff says, Bhavaveka's explanation is that Nagarjuna, as the author of a Rutic text, rather, obviously wants to condense a considerable amount of complex material into the shortest possible form. Why is that an adequate reason? I'm gonna argue with him here. Like, why does that make sense? Did they not have like a lot of paper or something, or a lot of time? Emily and then Rob.
Yeah, I kind of laughed at that too, because also, I mean, maybe I'm off about this, but the idea that an author would be like, I am writing a root text that then people can sort of spend
This is my
centuries
plan.
commenting upon.
Yeah, this is
Yeah,
my
like
plan.
it didn't I that didn't line up for me either. And yeah, the short that therefore I'm gonna make it really short, you'd almost think it'd be the opposite. Like this is gonna be foundational, so I better really spell it out.
And instead it's like, oh, I'm gonna go for the enigmatic, cryptic version and let people fight about it for 1,000 years. Rob and then Steve.
I was wondering, I don't know if this is true, but I was considering the possibility that these statements are so pithy because you don't want to spend a lot of discursiveness on on your time on the cushion. So you just drop in, you make it as pithy as possible to consider it.
Yeah, so part of your presumption is that these are like actual instructions for meditative contemplation.
Yeah.
And so that from that point of view, you don't want to be too wordy or intellectualize it, unnecessarily in that case, which is an interesting proposition. So then it's like, I would counter that, like if you look at the Mulla Karikas from that point of view, does it really seem like that whole text is like a meditative contemplation? I can see that your point. I understand and I agree with your point to some extent, but it's like at the same time he goes on quite a long time, 27 chapters, saying pretty much the same thing. Over and over again. So maybe it's drilling in the point,
Well, we're also supposed to do lots of short sessions, so.
At least 27.
Well, each chapter might have been a few sessions, because Nagarjuna was one of the root masters of the Mahamudra tradition. He was Saraha's disciple, right? So Rob is extrapolating in the Mahamudra tradition, we do these short sessions. So that makes sense.
The other thing is that we did see in the Ratnavali that he's perfectly capable of
Going on at
presenting
length,
longer form argumentation.
Steve.
It sort of relates to what you were talking about earlier about the long gaps between, somebody writing something and commentaries. And I just wonder if it's just a fact that somebody wrote something, maybe they taught a few people, and the tradition died out and the book ended up. There's three copies of that book in the entire Indian subcontinent. It ended up on a shelf in the Nalanda library. Nobody looked at it for years. Some, Buddhist nerd was going through wondering, gee, I wonder what's back here. And then found this book and said, whoa, this is interesting. I better think about this and write something up. There's a amazing book about sort of what happened when the printing press happened in Europe, and how slowly ideas ideas started to spread fast. And it was all because of the printing press, because finally there were not two or three copies of something. Something that was published in France could go to England. And so there was this huge burst in literature and philosophy and science and all this stuff. But even then, there were gaps, and some of the major books that people think of now as a really big deal were essentially lost for 60, 70 years because the right people didn't read them. They just, some guy printed 75 copies and they ended
It's
up on
so
people's shelves.
capricious. It's
Yeah.
so odd. And do you remember the name of that book? And was it about the nature of things, how Lucretius's nature of things suddenly became
Oh,
like a
which
major?
specific one? I don't know. This book was actually a, the book I'm talking about was actually a catalog of an exhibit in London back in 62, which was basically the history of the book in the West as told through the greatest books, essentially the most influential books ever written. And I turned on to this in a po podcast where Brian Eno was interviewed, and he said this is an amazing book because it covers 300 books, and you really see how ideas spread or didn't spread from one place to another. And it must have been so much worse back in India when they probably didn't have printing. Did they have printing presses in 1 AD? I don't know.
Yeah, the Buddha had actually invented
Yeah,
them.
did he have a whole stash of people? You know, what was written on palm leaves back then, for which probably disintegrated.
I think my favorite example of this is, Bach's unaccompanied cello suites,
Right.
the most famous
Yes.
piece of classical music,
Nobody cared.
was completely lost and was discovered in a thrift store in Barcelona in like the 1890s. The sheet music for
Unbelievable.
it.
Unbelievable.
But I wanted to move on, Emily first, and then we can move on.
I was just going to say that the Lucretius text, Derek, you mentioned is, yeah, there's a sort of an argument that the Renaissance never would have happened if they didn't find this missing Lucretius book
Yeah.
from ancient Greece.
Yeah, the
And it's
nature of
like,
things. It presented this whole idea that not everything comes from God.
And I just wanted to add the point. I mean, I think this is probably sort of obvious to this group, but you know, there's this whole literary history in Buddhism of this kind of undulation I find on topics from very concise and then sort of ballooning out into these really long commentaries on the same thing, and then people sort of get concise with it again, and even the same authors will write that they'll do have a concise version and a great version. So it seems to me like it's not that weird that, or not weird at all, that Nagarjuna has some of these just really pithy packaged versions of things, and then it then unfolds into thousands and thousands and thousands of pages of commentary, and then kind of collapses back in later on into shorter things and back again. And even like Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, you think of him, like some of his teachings are so short, it's like one paragraph. And then later on, then he gave like, you know, a se several long talks on the same thing. And so it's a interesting part of the tradition.
Yeah, just one last thing before Chris, you move on, is that in that vein, thinking about what was the literature up until that time, and the Buddhist literature had only begun to be written down like 200 or maybe 300, at most 300 years before Nagarjuna, and they most of the literature that was written down were the sutras, the Vinaya, and then these really long, very boring, didactic litany of topic type Abhidharma texts, including what the Vaibhashikas. Their main text was the Mahavibhasha, which was like this huge compilation of multiple texts that probably had enormous duplication in it. And so, maybe it does make sense that Nagarjuna would approach this, the Abhidharma, and sort of intentionally, really intentionally use this type of literary response to that voluminous tomes of literature. Anyway, let's move on. Chris.
So what we're looking at in many ways is the role of theses, in our argumentation in Madhyamaka. And Westerhoff actually points out a example in the Mula Madhyamaka Karika where Nagarjuna appears to make such a statement. This isn't in what we looked at last week, but on page 129, this little quote on the sort of the middle of the page. This is chapter 18, verse 9 of the Mula Madhyamaka Karikas, where Nagarjuna says, "Not to be obtained by means of another, pacified, free from hypostatization, without conceptualization, not having many separate things, that is the nature of reality." So this is a sort of stands out a little bit from most of his other statements. Westerhoff writes, "Of course, it is evident that all the terms Nagarjuna uses in this verse are negative. However, we have something here that is presented in the form of a thesis to, quote, to encourage those who are just beginning. Even though reality is ultimately beyond words, such negative characterizations can provide the basis of an eventual non-conceptual realization of the nature of reality." From his commentary on the passage, we can see clearly how Bhavaveka tries to bring together the need for a thesis to be defended on one hand, and the Madhyamaka reluctance to make any pronouncements on the ultimate nature of reality on the other. Elsewhere, Bhavaveka is more explicit, formulating the basic thesis of Madhyamaka himself. And this is the basic thesis: all things are empty of intrinsic nature, svabhava, and that is their nature. So this is, in some ways, cuts against this idea that Nagarjuna only uses prasanga. It may be that he almost only uses it, but here we have something that at least resembles a thesis. He does make a claim that something is the nature of reality. And what is that nature? Not to be obtained by means of another, pacified, free from hypostatization, without conceptualization, not having many separate meanings.
Let's talk about that statement, Rob.
What does hypostatization mean?
Yeah, what the hell is hypostatization?
I just looked it up. It's like reification is another, is a synonym. The act of treating an abstract concept as as a concrete real thing.
And then without conceptualization is similar. I guess hypostatization is sort of an extreme conceptual process. But what an interesting statement, not to be obtained by means of another. So, presumably going back to production, not produced by another, from another. Pacified.
Pacified is sort of the most curious.
It is. What a neat term, pacify. So is that, sometimes we hear like our mind, like shamatha, like Xinjiang, we're pacified, but like tamed. I don't think he's talking about reality as being tamed, but that it's the exhaustion of any activity, something like that, pacified, peaceful. It's where there's nothing going on, something like that.
Is he
And
talking about
this,
enlightenment?
well, it harkens back to a statement that's ascribed to the Buddha in the early sutras, where he talks about how he's found a state of being that's the deathless and it's peaceful and. We should find. I'm surprised he doesn't give that here because it does seem very reminiscent of that statement. Not having many separate meanings. What is the implication of that? It doesn't have separate meanings. We got to find alternate translations of this for next week and look at this one as a cool statement.
I was just
Anyways.
looking at they give the Sanskrit in the footnote. Not that I know Sanskrit, but I was wanting to start to look up each of the words.
In 124, yeah, I once knew Sanskrit, but I can't translate that. Nirvikalpam, so that's peaceful.
Do you want me to read another translation? This is Richard H. Jones, just because I had it in arm's reach.
Yeah, cool.
The characteristic of what is actually real is this: not dependent upon another, peaceful, free of being projected upon by conceptual projections, free from thoughts that make distinctions, and without multiplicity.
Without multiplicity is like without many parts, without many aspects, without many qualities or oneness. That is the nature of reality. That's cool. Okay. Anartam. And tatvasya lakshanam, marked by thusness. Anyway, yeah, so let's continue onward.
But I think it is worth noting that this is a much weaker thesis than the one Bhavi Viveka presents. That all, which Westerhoff puts at the end of that following paragraph, all things are empty of intrinsic nature, Swabhava, and that is their nature.
Yeah, and so did you touch on 128, the statement from the Garjuna, from the Vigraha Vyavartini? If I had any thesis, that fault would apply to me, but I do not have any thesis, so there is indeed no fault for me. So that's the vibe, you know, and the Garjuna sort of sets the standard of like, you know, no thesis. And Bhava Viveka then is like breaking the rule, and how does he? You know, he goes to great lengths of trying to defend himself for doing that. So all things are empty of intrinsic nature, and that is their nature. 127. Eccles, 2008.
So it goes to the, it speaks to not being able to conceptualize oneself into liberation.
Right. Yeah. So that is the main question, is like, what is the technique for letting go and achieving liberation? Liberation being a
And
letting go.
in the other reading, there was that mention of Kant coming to a similar conclusion about the ineffability of reality, but not recognizing the spiritual, magnificence of that, not recognizing the, what that implies.
And
Wasn't
putting
it?
it to trivial purposes.
Yeah. So,
Wasn't there something about Kant? He didn't believe that the mind could experience beyond conceptuality. Something like that. Like he conceptualized the possibility of there being a sort of a realm or a state of being beyond conceptuality, but he concluded that he just can't, or can't get there. Is that what they were saying? The West Wollstone, in so many words.
Well, Kant was recognizing an ineffability in trying to describe the beyond, that it's indescribable. But so then he just saw it as like, a trivial pursuit.
What did that mean? A trivial pursuit? Trivial because it couldn't be done, though.
Or, well, he didn't see any value in pursuing it.
Why? Because.
Well, because he couldn't articulate it, he couldn't share it.
I think it was because he couldn't experience it.
That probably too. But this is in a sense like having a view but no practice experience behind it.
Right. In our tradition, yeah, in our situation. Okay, so continuing the next paragraph, by establishing Madhyamaka with a thesis, he could ensure that the thought of Nagarjuna was able to contend in the intellectual arena. So it's like he felt compelled to come up with what he wasn't supposed to come up with. And ascribing a thesis to Madhyamaka, this appeared not just to have benefits through the Buddhist accounts seen from the inside, ensuring that amongst all the negations, the wrong affirmative statement was not embraced by mistake. So for students of Buddhism, but also from the outside, making sure that the philosophy could effectively debate with its opponents.
I think that's a really important point, is that Bhavaveka is, I think everyone here is sort of operating in good faith of, trying to expound the Dharma and reach people, and that the premise of Madhyamaka, or the, I don't want to say the premise of Madhyamaka, but the skillful means of Madhyamaka in whatever form is meant to bring people to liberation. And we have two very different strategies upon which Madhyamaka is being delivered to people. And I think on one hand, we can look at it in sort of a kumbaya way and say, well, that's great, different skillful means for different people. But I think the Prasangika is going to have a real issue, because what their criticism, and this is Chandrakirti's criticism, because Buddhapalita, maybe because he was dead, maybe not, didn't come up with a didn't offer a response to Bhavaveka. But Chandrakirti wants to say that in introducing theses and syllogisms, the Svatantrika is making ontological commitments that are bigger than just a difference in methodology. That if you and I, for the sake of argument, agree about the essence of a certain phenomenon, I've committed myself to a realist ontology in which real essences exist. And it may be I'm only doing this because I need to communicate with you. And you won't communicate with me if I don't accept, if we don't share common premises. But for Chandrakirti, this is starting off on completely the wrong foot. And the entire enterprise is going to be doomed to failure because of this fundamental issue being made.
Yeah, it's so interesting that he completely disagrees with all of Bhavaveka's premises, which we'll get to in a couple of weeks. But
If I can read from
sure.
Westerhoff to make sure which book it was, this is page 133, about Chandrakirti, first full paragraph. His main point is the observation that due to the.
We didn't have this today.
Oh, did we not? Well, never
Commentators. No,
mind.
we did, we did, we
We
did. We're
did.
supposed to go through 142. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. His main point is the observation that due to the curious nature of Madhyamaka thought, apparently procedural or exegetical matters, such as what format to present them in terms of prasanga arguments or syllogisms, could in fact not be confined to the merely formal, but have direct implications for the status of conventional reality. We can clearly see this in connection with Bhavaveka's emphasis on spelling out Madhyamaka arguments in terms of syllogisms. Such syllogisms bring with them a thesis that the syllogism is an argument for, a thesis that the Madhyamaka holds independent, Svatantra, of whatever their opponent accepts. As we have noted before, there seems to be a strong current in Nagarjuna's works to reject the acceptance of exactly such theses. We are no longer concerned here with the purely topic-neutral question of the best framework for explaining Madhyamaka teachings, because certain frameworks bring assumptions with them that have relevance at the level of the contents of the theory. So it appears that when making a syllogism that employs a thesis, the Svatantrika compromises on a core Madhyamaka issue, which is holding no thesis.
I so wish we could know like what Bhava Viveka's private conversations with his students were about meditation practice, for example, because it is so unclear whether, yeah, like we keep saying, this was sort of for a particular purpose, and maybe he was saying something rather different or not. I mean, I think the thing that makes me feel like maybe not is he's constantly saying that Buddhapada is like totally wrong, right? So I guess if he, I guess he does really, it seems like Baba Viveka really believes what he's saying, but I don't know. I just wish we had like some insight into how he spoke to other audiences.
Well, one of the theories, right, is that students were having wrong interpretations of Nagarjuna, and that Buddhapada's commentary wasn't helping, and was just, so what would be the problems that people might have with Nagarjuna's presentation and Buddhapada's of just like, basically thinking everything's emptiness in a nihilistic way, I guess. Or just like dispensing with all views. So let's talk more about Chandrakirti. And so we get again we have this interesting odd rather situation in the literary record that Chandrakirti was not well known in India. And there's like no cross-fertilization between different authors talking about each other at all. Which makes Bhava Vivek and Buddhapada's rift a little more interesting, that they're actually one of the earliest situations where you have teachers reacting directly to each other. Nobody reacts to Chandrakirti, and you have this huge commentary by Avalokiteshvara on Bhava Viveka's text, Avalokitevrata. And all he does is mention Chandrakirti as one of the authors of commentaries on
It's
Nagarjuna's
almost more
Bhava Viveka.
devastating that he mentions him.
Yeah, because then he knows about
He
it.
knows it exists. He's read it, but
And
he,
he's just
for
dismissive.
whatever, either this is from Westerhoff. He may have thought that Chandrakirti's arguments were so deficient as to be unworthy of a response, or so devastating that he did not know what to say.
Right. It's like, I don't know what to make of this guy. He's going to totally blast me out of the water. So I'm going to try to hide him, right? Try to put him out of the field by not mentioning him.
So then, I think this is a story we'll tell in greater detail at a later point. But Chandrakirti is, yeah, more or less not doesn't really make a splash in any way in India. His work is translated into Tibet in the 11th century, where it also doesn't really make a splash. But then somehow in the 14th century, it explodes and becomes the main thing, and to this day, the dominant point of understanding Madhyamaka across all Tibetan traditions, which previously had been Svatantrikas, the Prasanga becomes the authoritative view.
Well, that's an interesting statement that it had previously been Svatantrika. What is your basis for that? What do you mean by that, rather?
I guess what I mean is the view presented, by Kamala Shila.
And so you're calling that Svatantrika. Does he call it Svatantrika?
Well, no, he wouldn't, because that's a term that that's something of an anachronistic term, which is, I think, an important.
Westerhoff. Because Shantaraksha and Kamalashila created a synthesis of Yogacara and Madhyamaka. They weren't really Svatantrikas.
Well, I think we would want to describe them as Yogacara Svatantrika. They accept the theses of Yogacara, no?
On the relative level, but Prasangika on the ultimate level.
But I don't think that Prasangika, I don't think that a strict Prasangika such as Chandrakirti allows for that level of complexity philosophical complexity within their understanding of the relative.
Well, they don't. They right. So they differ. Kamala Shiela or Chandrakshita to differ radically on the relative, but the Swachandrikas, they give the relative like a relative truth, like a truth status. And the Swachandrikas, and then the Prasangikas deny that truth status and say, you think there's a tree there? Fine, I'll call it a tree. sort of make no statement about the relative. And but the Kamala Shiela Chandrakshita to view the relative as like an illusion, which is, and basically all three have the same understanding of the ultimate. They have Swatantra and Prasanga have different avenue of approach to the ultimate. The whole Prasanga versus Swatantra point of view. But anyway, the main point you're making is that up until that time, Tibet had a leaning towards, not towards the Prasanga, not towards Chandrakirti, even though it had been translated earlier. It's very, very bizarre. And then does he mention the two brothers from Nepal that translated it the second time in the 14th century?
I'm not sure that's in here. I don't think. Yeah, I don't think that one's in here. But let's not get too into the weeds about the
No, keep, yeah, so keep
translational.
going
Yeah,
on
but
Chandrakirti.
one point I wanted to make is that the distinction, the Svatantrika-Prasangika distinction, is a later invention. That is not; those are not terms that Buddhapalita or Bhavaveka used. But are back translated from Tibetan to fit these authors into a probably a more rigid scheme than they would have thought of themselves as being.
I think Chandrakirti does use the terms, but he doesn't like concretize them, and that later on they're used. But does Westerhoff say they're purely a back trans? Anyway, that's not
He
the
does at one
main
point,
point.
but
Yeah, so this whole distinction does not like gel for hundreds of years. Sorry, keep going with Chandrakirti.
So I think one of the really interesting distinctions here is that and Derek and I just sort of touched on it is regarding the status of relative truth. So the Prasanga and the Svatantrika both agree on the ultimate truth as the Madhyamaka emptiness, but from a Svatantrika point of view, they will acknowledge a certain level of philosophy to relative truth. So Swabhava exists, but on a relative level. Chandrakirti's criticism of this is that whether or not people believe Swabhava of the personal self, whether or not you believe you exist on a relative level or an ultimate level, doesn't really matter. The issue is clinging to a self is causing your suffering. And so Chandrakirti refuses to grant Swabhava on a relative level. And
That's a huge one that sounds sort of subtle, but I think it has like a really huge impact that when you make a positive statement or sorry, when you make a statement about some phenomena, even if it's negative, you've placed that phenomena in the field of like agreed upon reality. And then you have to like dispense with it. So take the six senses, for example, they are empty of nature. You then like have to transform them into emptiness. Whereas for Chandrakirti, not accepting the six consciousnesses, that it's necessary to sort of accept that there are these things and then dispense with them as empty. I think that's a very subtle but very important distinction in methodology of how we approach. It's almost like the opposite of the implicative negation, where like one negation implying the other, and here it's like one assertion. One has an assertion that has to be negated, and the other is like, I don't have to put forward that assertion, therefore I don't have to negate it.
And further, once you make an assertion, you're already screwed.
In what way?
You've already committed yourself to some sort of realist ontology.
Yeah, because and then you get into the whole thing of like, well, how does that thing that we agreed exists possess emptiness? And that's a rabbit hole that you're then stuck in.
You've also committed yourself to a methodology that might be counterproductive.
Right. The other thing is that Chandrakirti and Westerhoff talk about is this overly exuberant fondness for doxography that Bhava-Vivekananda has of like structuring different viewpoints in this very formalistic way is not necessarily a helpful exercise. Whereas, strangely, while what Chris said earlier about the Prasangika and Chandrakirti being the main accepted way of understanding Madhyamaka and all of Tibetan Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhists are obsessed with doxography. And there's a lot of difference in the way they understand Chandrakirti and Prasangika. And so you get separate from this whole thing of Rongtong and Zhentong that we get into much later, there's different ways of understanding Prasangika, where Gelugpa has a very very specific way of understanding Chandrakirti that has a lot that, according to other traditions, is like bizarre and way off the mark. And like not true Prasangika. And so that's what like this whole evolution is leading towards, those arguments that we'll get to eventually are really important.
One thing that I feels really sort of relevant to our contemporary situation that I think a lot about when I think about these two schools of thought, again, is the this issue of the way Prasangika, at least as presented in by Wollstone Fletcher, views, and Chandrakirti, views relative truth as, here, this is on bottom of page 28, Chandrakirti refers to the conventional as being simply the unexamined phenomena of ordinary experience, accepted as true by common consensus. The Prasangikas do not care to theorize about the conventional. They do not philosophize. A little later down, the Prasangikas simply accept without analysis the things and events occurring in everyday experience. So it seems as though if you accept that approach, that something like the project of modern science or physics, even medicine, is going to be very difficult to do. That any attempt to explain things in terms of mechanisms or causality is not only doomed to failure, but is the wrong approach altogether, and maybe a distraction. This is not an issue that Bhava Viveka is going to have. So it's and of course, as Derek was saying earlier, the Tibetans didn't exactly behave as though they always felt this way, you know, because they had cosmologies, they had biology, they had all sorts of divination systems. So there were real attempts to explain the world around them. Despite this sort of non-commitment that exists in Chandrakirti's presentation of Prasangika, of not wanting to make any commitments about the way the world exists.
It's interesting, though, that in a way, the less you philosophize about something, the more free you are to kind of come up with those cosmologies and stuff. Like there was the point in one of these readings of some of the sort of more mystical sounding. Who was it? Was it Chandrakirti? Someone was milking a picture of a cow,
That was
you
trying to
know,
kick
and it
you.
was, yeah, and it's sort of like free in a way, maybe counterintuitively, not philosophizing about the relative world kind of frees you up to be as sort of freewheeling as you want in your kind of mythological, cosmological, representational, artistic interactions with the world around you.
Yeah, that's good. Thank you for that. Derek, what's your point of view?
What's my point of view? I have no point of view. You gave me that, right? That was like the, you lobbed me that pitch.
I forget that I really just need to be like on the lookout for dad jokes around you.
Supposedly, Chandrakirti had numerous debates with a gentleman named Chandra Goman.
You're muted, which may or may not be a rhetorical device.
Somehow I did that. One thing that's interesting and would be interesting to find out more detail about is that there's these stories that apparently Chandrakirti had numerous debates with a gentleman named Chandra Goman, and lost repeatedly to Chandra Goman, and Chandra Goman was a Yogacara. The whole thing about the Vajrayana connection is an interesting way of the mystery is like, how did Chandrakirti suddenly become so popular and widely accepted as the ultimate point of view on this? And there's a number of tantric texts that are attributed to him and Aryadeva and Nagarjuna that are, as Westerhoff talks about towards the end of this reading, they are held to be the key figures in what are called the noble, the Arya transmission. Noble is the translation. Here he gives the Tibetan Pak Luk, which is Arya tradition of Aryas are used earlier as noble ones who have achieved the path of seeing or stream entry and above. And this is like a way of distinguishing a certain transmission of tantric texts and practices from the earlier tradition of enigmas and their whole system of kama and terma. And in particular, their main tantra is the Guhyasamaja Tantra. And this is the foundation of the Galupa system of tantra, as well as the one that it's similar to the stream that comes into the Kagyu lineage, as well as the Sakya lineage of Hevajra and Chakrasambhava, along with Vajrayogini. But this is an interesting possibility that because of these tantric texts being translated and circulated and ascribed to these authors, that gave them additional precedence.
Sort of like, you think the new release is good, you should check out his early stuff.
Right. But I like this part at the end about, like, towards the end of they didn't really see themselves as creating different schools, as you mentioned earlier, or like as ha creating like this huge rift that later it becomes evident, or in retrospect, that there is this huge rift between different ways of understanding Nagarjuna. But on the top of 137, I love this statement that for Chandrakirti Bhava Viveka, or Bhavi Veka. So for many years, scholars would say Bhava Viveka with three V's in there. And more recently, somebody decided there's only two. Bhavaviveka is not a Madhyamaka at all, but just a logician. That's quite an insult. I think Bhavaviveka would be very unhappy if he knew that people were writing about him in that way.
Well, it's even worse if you read the quote on the bottom of the page before that. Even though a logician may take the
Right.
side of the Madhyamaka school out of a desire to parade the extent of his own dialectical skill, it is evident that the presentation of Svatantra reasoning becomes for him an enormous reservoir where faults pile up one after another. I mean, what a diss!
Really, they didn't
Like,
hold
send
back.
this man to the burn unit.
They didn't hold back, did they?
But this also, just while we're on this page, a few sentences up, what we were talking about earlier about the back translation. Even the terms prasanga and svatantrika were not used by Indian Madhyamakas to describe their own positions, but are retranslations from terms later Tibetan doxographers used in order to provide a systematic description of the different views Madhyamaka authors held. So we can see that. This distinction that so much commentarial has so much commentary has sprung up around is not one that was really necessarily held by the people it's ascribed to.
History, interesting.
I wanted to share just one paragraph from the Wollstone Fletcher. That I found, because it's so easy within Prasanga to focus on the negative, since that's all sort of they offer.
Where are you, Chris?
I'm on page 25 in the source text, of
Gotcha.
which is going to be page it's going to be page 235 in our source book. And it's that first full paragraph, and I'm just going to read it. A perception of the limitations of thought may seem, as we have said, a sorry conclusion to the philosophical enterprise. Until one notices that the implications for the mind that reaches this conclusion are immense. The very fact that the discovery is possible points to something beyond the ordinary intellect. To realize by thought that there is an ultimate truth that is not the object of thought is no ordinary finding. It is not just the negative conclusion of dialectical analysis, but also the discovery of a wholly new dimension of the mind itself. When the mind realizes emptiness, it overcomes the subject-object dichotomy. It does not just break through the appearances that conceal the ultimate status of phenomena, it also penetrates the veils of mental construction that had concealed its own true nature and made the misperception of phenomena possible. When the true nature of phenomena is discovered, the mind's nature also stands revealed, for the realization of emptiness is the experience of non-dual wisdom. Looked at from this point of view, the final outcome of Manyamaka analysis is not a negative, but a profoundly positive experience. And I just thought that was so beautiful on one hand, and on the other, it seems to show that what Nagarjuna and the Prasangikas are engaged with is not sort of a mere display of sophistry of tearing down the opponent's arguments for the sake of tearing them down, but is can we say non-implicatively pointing us somewhere else, pointing us beyond the limitations of conceptual mind.
So it's implicatively non-implicative, but it's sort of implicative. It's like implying, well, there is something beyond conceptual mind.
If the mind can realize it, then there's something, some non-thing there to be realized, some non-conceptual thing to be realized.
Yeah, that was that whole point of like, is there something left when every swabhava is negated? Wolfson brought it up early on, and it's an interesting idea that even though the Buddha wouldn't answer a lot of different questions, he was emphatic about his own enlightenment and his own discovery of some sort of reality beyond the mind. And there was no, that was very clear. That was not something that it was very unabashed. So next week we do.
That's the part that Kant couldn't get to.
Right.
Indeed. He can't get there. Yeah.
He speculated about its existence, but yeah, he didn't. What he lacked was a sophisticated method of meditation.
Yeah, for sure. Same as
All he
William
had were
James.
those long walks around Königsberg.
Yeah, he didn't have the technology.
Yeah.
So next week we dive into Buddha Politas text, his commentary on the first chapter, and should be interesting to for one go through a solid classical writing as opposed to these expository, largely expository writings that we've been looking at, and one that's not that easy to go through. So those of you who get to it early on and want to share with us, or Chris or I, like what pages do we want to focus on? Let us know. Anything else? We've been talking about these commentaries for years, Buddhapada and Bhava-viveka and the Rinmai Sheja, and I'm sort of excited to finally delve in and see what they're like and what they're saying.
I think we'll quickly learn why we haven't read them before.
I think that's what I suspect too, is they are not like thrillers, that's for sure. Michael Jackson. Okay, let's dedicate our marriage and close. Chris, you want to lead us in the dedication?
Happily. By this merit, may all obtain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy wrongdoing. From the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, everyone. Bye, Debbie. Thank you for joining us. Look at Debbie's in a car somewhere. Where
Oh.
are you, Debbie? You're on a
I've been driving
cruise
home
ship.
from Oregon to the San Francisco Bay Area.
That's great.
Drive
Debbie
safe.
is all over the place.
Thank you.
Unbelievable.
Bye-bye.
Good night, everyone. Thank you for joining. Nice to see you.